give you the roll call. Justice Prosser is not participating, and Justice Bablich is participating, although both are absent for the moment. Okay. I'll call 00-1700, In Re the Commitment of Lenny Keating, State v. Keating, Assistant State Public Defender Margaret Maroney, appearing for Mr. Keating, and Warren Weinstein, appearing for the State. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Margaret Maroney, Lenny Keating's attorney, and this case is before the Court on certification from the Court of Appeals. And the first issue that the court has to decide is whether there's a requirement that a court consider any less restrictive alternatives to revoking the supervised release of a person who's been committed under Chapter 980. I know the court has been busy with a lot of Chapter 980 cases, so I feel that I can just use that shorthand. Going to be first an argument that there is a requirement, and then second that the requirement wasn't fulfilled in this case. First of all, the statutes, although the one dealing with revocation of supervised release does not specifically mention least restrictive alternatives, when it's read in conjunction with the Patients' Right Act, the legislature expressly requires consideration of a less restrictive alternative. And the statute that deals with the revocation is 980.08 sub 6M. And I'm going to refer to the current statute because it is the same language as what was in effect at the time of Mr. Keating's hearing. It's just been renumbered. And I'm going to read some of the language because there are three terms that I want to emphasize. If the court determines after hearing that any rule or condition of release has been violated, or that the safety of others requires that supervised release be revoked, it may revoke the order for supervised release. And then it continues. The words that I want to emphasize are any rule or condition. The fact that the basis for the revocation can be a violation of any rule or condition, or it may be that the safety of others requires that the supervised release be revoked. And that or is important. It's an or and it's not an and. So there can be a decision to revoke the supervised release of a person on the basis of a rule violation without the court being required to find that public safety requires the revocation of the supervised release. Now, even though the legislature doesn't talk about alternatives in this part of the statute, excuse me, it does in 5161 sub 1E. And in that statute, the legislature specifically accepts criminal commitments from its coverage. And it says that except in the case of a patient who's admitted or transferred under 5135(3) or 5137 or under Chapter 1, oh, I'm sorry, 971 or 975, except for that group, patients have the right to the least restrictive conditions necessary to achieve the purposes of admission, commitment, or protective placement. So the legislature could have but didn't exclude Chapter 980, and that is the express statement by the legislature that the least restrictive alternatives must be considered when making decisions about the revocation of the supervised release. Now, the second basis why I believe the court should find authority is a constitutional basis. And of course, if the court does not agree with my statutory interpretation argument, it will move to the constitutional issue. And
Before you go to the constitutional,
yes.
On your statutory interpretation argument, the statute that you're referring to in Chapter 51, the Patient's Bill of Rights, provides a right, and it does apply to Chapter 980 defendants or respondents, a right to the least restrictive conditions necessary to achieve the purposes of admission, commitment, or protective placement, etc. It doesn't say the least restrictive placement.
No, if I emphasize protective placement, I did not mean to. The commitment, though, is the court orders a person committed to the custody of the department for control, care, and treatment. So the commitment includes whatever type of custody and control and care the department is providing the individual. And it could be a locked facility like Sandridge now, or it could be a community placement with supervision.
Okay, maybe I didn't make myself clear. My question went to the issue of whether this statute governs placement decisions made by a court, or whether it simply governs decisions that are made within the institution or department to which the person is committed as to the kinds of conditions that they will be subjected to.
Oh, thank you. I did misunderstand. Well, this court has said that the Patient's Rights Bill applies to people committed under Chapter 980. And I know in the brief, I did refer to a case where the court, it is on page 13 of my brief, and in that instance, the court read Chapter 51 and 980 together to find statutory authority for a circuit court to issue an order for involuntary medication. And that would not necessarily have to be something that takes place in an institution. People can be ordered to show up at their doctor's office to receive a shot. So that is authority that Chapter 51 and Chapter 980 should be read together.
Right, and I don't disagree with that, but I don't know that there is any authority for the proposition that this provision in Chapter 51 in the Patient's Bill of Rights governs the court's decision-making with regard to the commitment, the initial commitment of somebody found to be a sexual predator, or the revocation of supervised release. Certainly there is none for the latter. That's what we'll hear about today. But I don't know if there's any authority for the suggestion that this statute governs a court's decision-making on where to place the defendant, as opposed to the institution's decision-making about what kind of conditions to subject the defendant to.
Well, I respect the fact that that is a difficult decision, and I believe that if the court is troubled at all about the statutory basis, which is the first argument, I think that the constitutional argument is compelling, and that may be a reason to construe the statute so as to avoid it being violative of due process.
What's the due process issue?
The due process issue is the fact that the least restrictive alternative is the touchstone of due process. I read that in one of Justice Beyer's opinions. Actually, it's his dissent in Kansas versus Hendricks, which this court is getting very familiar with. And it just caught me, because I've heard justices or read them referring to the cornerstone of due process, and I had an idea what cornerstone meant, but touchstone, I really had to look that one up. And Webster's Dictionary says that it's a black silica stone related to flint and formerly used to test the purity of gold and silver by leaving a streak left on the stone when rubbed by the metal. The second definition is a test or criterion for determining the quality or genuineness of a thing. And the least restrictive alternative is the touchstone in testing the genuineness of this being a civil commitment. Because a civil commitment has to balance the interests of the state and the interests of the individual and come to that balancing point, which is the least restrictive alternative. And this court in Post recognized the importance of that concept of the least restrictive alternative. It spoke of due process requiring that the nature and the duration of the commitment be narrowly tailored to the purpose. And narrowly tailored is the same idea as least restrictive alternative. And if it isn't the least restrictive alternative, it looks like punishment. That's what Justice Beyer writes, and that's what the court was concerned of also, I believe, in Carpenter. Because Carpenter said there's a supervised release provision, so there's no ex post facto problem. So the court was relying on the fact that people would be restrained of their liberty in the least restrictive alternative that still protects the public, but yet respects the fact that the civil committee has a very important liberty interest. So, yes, Your Honor.
No, please finish.
Okay. Well, actually, I am at a good break.
Okay, I thought. Good. Certification from the Court of Appeals. Number one doesn't mention, as I read it, 5161. Number two has in a footnote that we're not talking about due process because the respondent has not argued due process. So, number three, the certification really asks us not about due process, not about 5161E. The certification is set forth, I think, in the last paragraph, asks this, essentially. Do the policy considerations set forth in the ABA standards, which we adopted for purposes of parole and probation, do those policy considerations apply here such that in a 980 revocation proceeding, we should require consideration of the least restrictive alternatives? That's the question that was certified to us by the Court of Appeals, as I understand it. Doesn't mean we have to decide this case based on that. But first of all, let me ask, number one, if you agree with my characterization of the certification of the Court of Appeals.
I do, Your Honor.
Number two, then, why is it that you are proceeding on 5161 and now due process and not tackling the issue of public policy that was the motivating factor in parole and probation revocation should be applied here vis-a-vis the ABA standards? Why aren't you tackling that?
Actually, my next argument was going to be that a third reason why the court should find that there's a requirement is the policy reasons. And I don't know if the court wanted me to respond to some of the points that you mentioned in terms of the certification, but I just would like to point out that the state has not argued that the issue is waived, and that my constitutional argument is to show that you need to construe the statutory language as I have argued, or it would result in an unconstitutional law.
We all do a lot of reading, so I may have missed something. I don't recall seeing in your brief the public policy argument.
Well, I will look as I start talking about it.
It's okay if it isn't there. I just want to...
Sure. I am going to look as I talk, but the point being that, well, I know in the reply brief I responded and I believe got
yes,
into this
right.
about
in the
you need to have standards in order for the decision maker to make its decisions, or you will have arbitrary decisions.
Ms. Maroney, before
yes.
you leave the due process argument and get into a public policy argument, can I ask you some questions about the due process argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. You've been arguing from some language from Justice Breyer. What about the Romano case? Doesn't the Romano case run counter to your argument that the court is required here as a matter of due process to look at alternatives? Where do you get that in I know you use the touchstone language, but where do you get this idea that there's a constitutional requirement that the court must look at alternatives, and not just alternatives, the least restrictive alternative is what you've argued. Where does that come from?
Well, that comes from the due process law that's developed in the context of civil commitments. And this really does test whether this is a civil commitment or not, because, yes, Black versus Romano, and I'm going to get into it a little bit more, but that's a criminal case, not a civil case.
I recognize that
that's
a case involving probation and revocation of probation, but doesn't it still have some relevance in regard to the issue of due process?
Well, yes, Your Honor, I agree it does. The court specifically said, though, there's substantive due process and there's procedural due process. And procedural due process does not require the court to give reasons for the decision it made. And it specifically said we're not going to decide the substantive due process issue. Now, there was reference to the fact that the party had an opportunity to present argument and evidence about alternatives. So possibly the fact that the court could, maybe there was no substantive due process violation because the arguments were made before the court and the court rejected them. The court did not give reasons on the record. That's procedural due process. So I would say that Black v. Romano does not cut away the constitutional argument for the fact that it was a procedural due process case, and then, of course, the fact that it was a criminal rather than civil case.
Well, let me ask you something else, because I'm not sure that I understand your argument in this case, and I'm not trying to get you out of sequence. But in this particular situation, you're arguing that there's a statutory violation, that there's a violation of due process. But are you arguing that in the abstract, or are you arguing in regard to what actually occurred in this case? The reason I refer to that is because when I look at the transcript of what occurred in front of Judge Mason, Judge Mason refers to alternatives. He asks questions about alternatives. There's testimony given, or a statement given at least, by Ms. Spouty in regard to the consideration of alternatives. It's not like, at least as I read this transcript, that the judge ignored the possibility that there might be an alternative to putting this man back in the institution.
I think that it's important for this court to decide the legal issue in the abstract, whether or not the law requires a court to consider less restrictive alternatives when deciding whether to revoke a person's supervised release. As to whether or not, assuming there is a requirement, whether it was met in this case, I get very frustrated when I think about the facts of this case, because when the Department of Corrections wanted, and the Department of Health and Family Services wanted to cooperate, they did. And they had the Department of Corrections agent supervise Mr. Keating. But when it came time to revoke the supervised release, and at that time he also had a corrections supervision as well, a probation, they chose to proceed with the sex crimes commitment and to revoke that. And at that hearing, the agent, who was a Department of Corrections employee, says to the court, you know, if this were a probation revocation, we would have to consider alternatives, and we would have alternatives because we have halfway houses. But this is Chapter 980, and you don't have to consider alternatives. And then the court proceeded. The court never said anything to that would suggest it was considering alternatives. The entire discussion can boil down to the fact that, gee, if this were Department of Corrections revocation, we'd have to consider least restrictive alternatives. But this is the Department of Health and Family Services now, and we don't have any, and we don't have to consider any.
Well, didn't Judge Mason conclude that there had been violations of rules by your client, that those violations were intentional, that he had been deceitful, that he felt that there was a danger of reoffending, and therefore he felt that institutional placement was appropriate? Didn't he make all of those findings on the record?
He made those findings on the record, but he never at all indicated its understanding that I understand I have to consider whether or not there is any less restrictive alternatives. And the parties did not present evidence as to least restrictive alternatives. And that's what Mr. Keating is asking for, a remand, to have a hearing where he can present evidence on less restrictive alternatives. The thing that from day one the experts agreed on was that Lenny Keating belonged in a supervised group home. That's never been provided to him. On the policy argument, I refer the court to my reply brief. I do get into that sound policy on pages 5 and 6, and I'm not going to take the time right now to look for it in my brief in chief, though during the state's argument I will.
No need to.
And so I think that the policy arguments fall into two categories. One, we want to provide the decision maker with standards. Standards are necessary so that there are not arbitrary decisions. And the way the statute is written requires no dangerousness type assessment. It's any rule or violation on the one hand, or that public safety requires it. So a court could proceed under the first prong and say Lenny Keating violated a rule of supervision because he didn't come to an appointment that we had scheduled, or that he had scheduled with the agent. But it might turn out that the reason he didn't show up was that his transportation fell through and he wasn't there for that reason. But under the law as written, the court could decide to revoke the supervised release because there's no requirement that the court do that type of balancing. You know, what is the less restrictive alternative in light of this violation? Now, that's one area that gets into the public policy, and we want to have consistent decisions, and we want to have standards for our trial courts to administer. And then second, this court decided in the context of probation and parole that it was, well, in the context of probation, it said, I'm going to follow, or we are going to follow what we decided in an earlier case. And the state's position is that, well, the Supreme Court here misread the United States Supreme Court, and that has been clarified. However, there has been no, the Department of Corrections after Black v. Romano did not change its administrative rules. It still is, has determined that it's good public policy to consider less restrictive alternatives. There hasn't been any litigation that I know of in the appellate courts where the state is arguing that we should not, we should overrule our earlier cases in Plotkin and Van Erman and say the department no longer has to consider less restrictive alternatives. I think there's a consensus in the actors in the criminal justice system that that is a good policy decision.
Oh, I think if you talk to the rank and file agents who do this work day in and day out, there would be a lot of complaints about Plotkin.
Pardon me?
There are a lot of complaints about Plotkin and its workability as a general proposition among the
agents. I should have been more specific in terms of at the appellate level. I have not seen any sign on the appellate level to urge this court to overturn its earlier precedent.
And then, Maroney?
Yes.
I'm not sure I understand this case, so let's just double back. Mm-hmm. You have a client who has an IQ of 72, which is what?
That's
normal?
Right.
Well, it's borderline mentally retarded.
Okay. And your client had a sexual assault conviction.
Yes.
And then when it was time for release, he came under 980. Okay?
Yes.
And under 980, he was supposed to get supervised release. There were several cases that involved that.
Right.
And the department, this is not the first case, but correct me, but where the department is having trouble doing anything but institutionalized.
Right, this court.
And we've been assured, I think, by the state that things are better, that they're going to have special institutions for a 980 and that they can handle a whole variety of ranges, but that the statute also has been amended since this to limit supervised release. What's background?
He was on supervised release when these violations took place. In other words, he was held in a supervised setting with an agent in it.
Okay, I'm going to get to that. So, after a couple of rounds, they put him in a duplex. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
On electronic monitoring.
Right.
Because they couldn't get him accepted into a group home or some other supervised.
Right. A group home that was privately owned. There were private group homes that take developmentally disabled individuals. Mm-hmm. And actually one had accepted and then withdrew.
Okay.
But okay, be quiet.
I'm sort of trying to see where we are. So he's now in this duplex. Did the state buy this duplex? They renting
it? No, they rented it.
They rent both parts or just one part?
They only rented the one part, which is the lower part, and actually problems started to occur because the landlord wanted to rent the upper flat.
And the state was concerned about somebody else being there?
Yes.
For purposes of monitoring him? Or safety of others?
Safety. Perhaps a family
would have made it with children. Since he obviously can be taken advantage of.
Yes.
So now he has a series of violations. I see you don't object on the ground. Maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't hear an objection on the ground that all of these violations amount to not much.
I'm not arguing that today. I think that if this were a trial court, I would want to argue that.
Okay.
But this isn't.
All right. Well, we got violations, and it's at least arguable, and I don't say they're not violations, although maybe some of them aren't, but some of them are. So now he's up for revocation of, put it into my terms, revocation of a super, what, I'm sorry, what's it called? A supervisory release, right?
Yes.
All right. Now, the, if I understand the department, the state's position, and we'll get to Mr. Weinstein, the state's position is that it's up to the judge to either revoke or not revoke. There is discretion. The statute uses the word may.
Yes.
Right? Okay. Your position is that, true, they can either revoke or not revoke, but you add in a factor, if I understand your position, and that is that, and this is where I need help, is that in determining whether to revoke, that they look at the least restrictive alternative, or is it on revocation that the court is to place him in the least restrictive alternative or order the department to replace him in the least restrictive alternative? Where does that come in this stage of the procedure?
Well, Your Honor, the least restrictive alternative is found in the patient's bill of rights.
I understand that. So, I'm telling you, what does the, where does the judge fit that, making its decision?
It modifies the supervised release plan. The department, in order, when we go back to the point where the judge put Mr. Ketting on supervised release, the department had to submit a plan, and they submitted it to Judge Mason. And in it, they explained where he would live and things like that. So what the court would do is say, I want to modify the supervised release so that he lives in a group home or halfway home and prepare a plan.
I'm not revoking his.
I'm not revoking, but I am modifying.
Because I think that although he's violated, this, these violations don't amount to enough to revoke when I do my balancing, like in revocation of parole, right?
Right.
And so what I, but we got to do something more than we're doing now because he's going to get in trouble. So I want you to modify the plan. Is that it? So we're going to continue him under supervisory release, but we're going to increase the supervision.
Yes.
And that's where this least restrictive alternative comes in?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's what the court should do, and that you, they ask the department to modify the plan. And what would the modification here be that you think should be done?
Well, at this point, there hasn't been a hearing to flesh out what alternatives there are. What I would like to do is to have it remanded and have a hearing, since the department now has had time and has, you know, said that they're going to be developing programs. A lot might have changed since the time Judge Mason had the case in front of him. And there is the option that the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Family Services can contract for a person in the control of the Department of Health and Family Services live in the Department of Corrections halfway house. I would, and Mr. Ketting would like to explore that alternative.
He's under the Department of Corrections, too.
Yes, they did not revoke.
Okay. So that's what you would expect. And you think that's required under the statutes, really 980 and the Victims' Bill of Rights, I gather. You think that it's due process, substantive due process, because otherwise, if you don't do that, you've turned 980 into punishment, not treatment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that public policy, you think, demands it because this is like revoking parole.
Well, public policy would say this is even more important, conditional liberty, than parole and probation.
Because he's not a criminal. He's
right.
Already served his criminal.
He's already served his punishment, and what we are now interested in is finding that right balance between public safety and treatment needs and liberty rights.
Suppose he was a 51 civil commitment, not a 980, and he was. How would that work?
If there were a recent overt act, a recent overt dangerous act, that would be a basis for recommitting the person.
So it would be even a civil commitment, but he's released from an institution, that's possible, is that right? But still be under civil commitment.
I am going to double check to be sure, but that is what I recall about Chapter 51, and I'm going to look at the statutes during the state's argument.
Okay, we've held you over. You've got 5 minutes. And
well, I think we really have covered everything that I hope to cover, and maybe I'll have the opportunity to answer some more questions during rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maroney. Assistant Attorney General Warren Weinstein, representing the state of Wisconsin. Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this case. It's our position that alternatives to revocation may be a fine thing that the court take into consideration, but it's not required to do so. It's not in the statute. I do not read Chapter 51, 61, 1E as adding anything to the 980.08 sub 4. I believe the statute adequately sets forth standards for the trial court to consider.
What are they? We agree that there's a violation.
In making a decision under this subsection, sub 4, which is the revocation section, the court may consider without limitation because of enumeration the nature and circumstances of the behavior that was the basis for the allegation in the petition, the person's mental history, present mental condition, where the person will live, how the person will support himself or herself, what arrangements are available to ensure that the person has access and will participate in necessary treatment. It's all the same
stuff.
What's
the last one?
I'm sorry?
What arrangements? What does that say?
I'm sorry. What arrangements are available to ensure that the person will have access to and participate in treatment?
Well, why do you think least restrictive
including
alternative
formalized
doesn't come under that?
I'm sorry?
Why don't you think least restrictive alternative doesn't come under arrangements that are available so that he can participate?
Well, I don't think least restrictive adds anything. The statute, 5161E, says the least restrictive necessary to the achievement of the purposes of the commitment. The purposes of the commitment, we've heard a number of times, both from the United States Supreme Court and this court and the Court of Appeals, is protection of the public and treatment. What does the circuit court decide when it decides to revoke, when it exercises its discretion, having already found a violation? And that is, what is the appropriate placement for this person given their level of dangerousness and their need for treatment. Is that any different than less restrictive necessary to achieve the purposes of the commitment? I don't think so.
Well, and do you agree with Ms. Maroney that in determining whether to revoke, the trial court should consider what arrangements are available for this person to get treatment and whether available arrangements protect the public?
Are they required to?
Yeah.
Well, the statute says without limitation. I think the ultimate thing that the trial court has to do in looking at all of those factors is to determine how dangerous is the person, what are their treatment requirements, and how do I balance that with the security facilities that are both available here and in the secure mental health facility setting. And I put the person where he or she is most appropriately placed on those options.
I don't hear how you differ then. I mean, on the one hand, I hear you say that implicit in arrangements available to participate in treatment as well as public safety, that includes least restrictive alternatives.
I guess here's where I differ. First of all, I don't differ, I guess, if you agree with me that it doesn't add anything. I do not
think... If it doesn't add anything, then it's there already. Then you totally... Well, you both agree.
I do not agree that least restrictive alternative is a requirement of due process. I do not agree that under the statutory history of this statute, least restrictive is something that the circuit court must consider. Under the original statutory language, which has since been repealed, interestingly enough, I suspect maybe that was the generation of basis for your question, Justice Sykes. The statute said the trial court shall determine the placement, either secure mental health facility or supervised release. The department shall place the person in the least restrictive alternative or the least restrictive placement consistent with the trial court's order. So I would say, based on that history, that the least restrictive aspect has never applied to the circuit court. This case doesn't really raise that question, I don't think, but that's my view on it, for whatever
well,
it's worth.
Well, your opposing counsel indicates that the question is raised in terms of I understood the argument to be that if it's not the least restrictive, it's punishment.
Well, I mean, we've been down that road, too, and I disagree with that.
Okay, well, for instance, let's say a kid misbehaves and hits someone, fourth grade playground, and the teacher brings the kid in and you stay in for the day.
What?
I would say, stay in for recess. I would say that that might be the reasonable thing. You don't hit Sally and you stand here and cool down. But if the teacher says, okay, you did that, I'm going to expel you from school for the rest of the year, I might say, ooh, that seems a bit like punishment.
Yeah, and that's fine for the school, but the jurisprudence of double jeopardy and ex post facto don't go down that road.
Well,
we look at this.
When I wrote State versus Carpenter, I think
well,
I
Well, but Carpenter was before Hendricks, it was before Hudson, it was before a lot of Supreme Court jurisprudence on double jeopardy. And I think it's pretty clear from those cases that the only thing you look at in determining whether punishment is the statutory language. What is the intent of the legislature? So the fact that an administrative agency doesn't administer the statute correctly may look like punishment, but what it is a violation of the statute. It does not convert the statute into punishment.
Now, recently I had a patient, if I see a bird and it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, I call that bird a duck.
Except when the Supreme Court says it's not a duck.
And if it feels like punishment, it looks like punishment, it sounds like punishment, it smells like punishment, I guess I call it punishment.
You're the judge. I was listening to the Chief Justice, and it's really read your pros and cons of the case and say that we were. But here, as I understand it, Judge Mason was looking at a person who was up. He was on supervised release. And then Judge Mason looked at reasons brought before him why he may or may not keep this person on supervised release. And one of those is protection of the public, as they're looking whether he should go into a more secure facility, more secure, but be able to protect the public. And I was looking, and I guess that on your brief, page 19, you say that the court demonstrates a reasonable process based upon the facts of this record, and the facts, some of them Judge or Justice Brooks alluded to, but the trial court indicated that its decision to revoke his supervisor release was based upon determination that his violation was intentional. Now, he's looking back at what got Mr. Keating in trouble in the first place, and he says that it was intentional, he was deceitful and devious, and based upon his deceit and other evaluations of his quote, treatment provider, he was too high a risk to reoffend to remain on supervised release. So it seems to me the judge was looking, I'm assuming, I'm just reading from the brief here, that the judge was looking at his, seems to be looking at alternatives and decided that supervised release, where he would be in the public side without all these safety precautions, was too high of a risk. So, I mean,
I think that's a fair reading of the trial court's decision.
No, go ahead.
Judge Mason first made a specific finding of whether or not there were violations.
And there were five of the alleged and he found three.
Right. That's right. And I think Mr. Keating admitted two of them. He then proceeded to, and of course all the evidence came in at once, but this is the way he analyzed it. He then proceeded to look at some of the underlying behaviors that he believed was evidenced by the violations and some other conduct that wasn't alleged to be violations.
Well, and that was like cut off of the small
right.
boys and keeping them hidden.
Right. Yes.
Correspondence.
Yeah, he looked at that as evidence of deceit. And then he had specifically, I actually don't remember if Judge Mason asked or one of the lawyers asked, but someone asked the treating psychologist if he thought deception and deceit was important in assessing Mr. Keating's risk, and the psychologist said, yeah, he did. And the judge credited that.
Well, tell me how you'd write this opinion. One easy way of writing it is to say, the judge did consider the least restrictive alternative. I didn't find any. We therefore affirm, and we don't have to reach the decision whether, as a matter of law, he had to, because he did.
That's one way to resolve the case.
That's one way to resolve the case.
to resolve the case.
I would prefer that you resolve the case along the same lines as State versus Jefferson, which is that the court is permitted but not required to consider alternatives of revocation. And I base that, first of all, I find no due process requirement, but the policy concerns, it seems to me, are what type of people are we dealing with, and what is the derivation of the requirement in the context of probation and parole. And if as I read the Plotkin case, the concern that court had was with the fact that the argument advanced by, then it was DHFS, which now is, I guess it would be corrections, did not take into account the rehabilitation aspect of the probation. That's something that's not present here. We're dealing with treatment and protection of the public, not rehabilitation. And the response the court had to DHFS's complete ignorance of rehabilitation was to adopt 5.1 of the ABA standards on probation, which specifically require the court to consider the rehabilitative aspects of revoking or not revoking. And that seems to me to be a reasonable solution. I'm not sure that makes it applicable here, though, because we're not considering that same...
Well, aren't we considering treatment?
Yes, we are considering
treatment. Is that comparable to rehabilitation?
But we're not talking here about an alternative to treatment. We're talking about an alternative to placement, which almost always deals with protection of the public, not with treatment.
Counsel, what alternative existed here? Now, my view of this case is you have a fellow who 72 IQ, sexual predator. So you've got a couple of psychologists testifying that he's okay for supervised living in a group home, I think they said, supervised group home. Well, then you have the judge say, well, I know that's what they, this may not be the right order. The judge, anyway, says, there's nothing available here in Wood County. Goes up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals says, hey, look through the whole state. So then the case goes back down to the Wood County judge, and lo and behold, they come up with an placement in Richland County, except they won't take him. You know, here's a sexual predator. He wants a sexual predator. And then they have a placement in Jefferson County, and they're going to take it, but then the sheriff of Jefferson County apparently put a quash on that, who wants a sexual predator. So here's a guy with a 72 IQ. No one's going to take him. So what are you going to do? You've got a judge who's ordering it because the Court of Appeals says you've got to do it. So, ha-ha, there's an empty duplex. I mean, it's like a placement doomed for failure. You take a guy with a 72 IQ, no supervised group home, no supervised halfway house. You put him in an empty duplex. God forbid that there even be someone else living on top, because as soon as they get someone else on top, they want to take them out. So when I read this transcript saying there is no alternative for placement, I read it as saying, hey, we got no place to put this guy because no one's going to take this sexual predator.
You forgot La Crosse and Dane County.
Okay. Mea culpa.
And that's true. And that's
so there is no alternative to placement because no one's going to take a 72 IQ, sexual predator. I don't care what the psychologists say. They can say he should be in supervised living. They can say they need group home. No one's going to take him. No neighborhood's going to take him. No sheriff's going to take him.
Well, that's...
I'm asking counsel the question.
If you're asking me what should we do about it, I could come up with some things, but it's not for me to do it. It's for the legislature to do it.
Okay. Is there an alternative given now that you've added La Crosse and Dane and Richland and Jefferson? Is there an alternative for alternative in the community for this? For this respondent?
I don't know. And a apparently Judge Mason didn't believe there was. I might point out that when the judge tried to put him in La Crosse County, there was a, La Crosse County people actually appealed to the Court of Appeal.
So what do we do? I mean, that's my problem. You know, we've been down this road before. That's my problem because there is no alternative. How can I ask this judge to consider a least restrictive alternative when there is none in existence?
I think that's a very good question, and while it might not be the way one would write this opinion, it is a very practical consideration. Trial judges, I think, struggle mightily when they get evidence that shows somebody's supposed to be on supervised release, because experience has shown that if it's not the public that goes crazy, it's county government or a sheriff or whoever.
No, and the experience that I've seen, again, through my lens, which may not always be through my lens, is this kind of thing. We try it.
Court says, I order it. Court of Appeals says, I order it.
Finally, 3 or 4 years go by, and as here, he was found to write letters, number one, as a violation. Number two, lie about writing those letters. And number three, incur debt without telling his probation officer or whatever. And for those three things, most likely this respondent will spend the rest of his life in institution because La Crosse and Dane and Richland and Jefferson and no one else will take him. So for writing a letter, 9 letters, let me be accurate, lying about it, you know, I mean, he knows he wasn't supposed to write a letter. And so, jiggers, it's up. So he's lying about it. I mean, you know, God, this guy's a 72 IQ. And then he incurs some debt. And we're supposed to keep him in prison for the rest, essentially in prison, for the rest of his life?
Well,
so tell me what we're going to do about this.
Well, first of all, he's not like most people out there. He's got a mental disorder, and he's dangerous, and we know that in the past he's acted on that dangerous to the extent that he's committed serious crimes.
I know, but I guess what goes through my head
is that
if he had, as the psychologist had testified to, that both testified to, he belongs in a supervised group home, if one of those places would have given him, rather than, you know, this is like sending a 16-year-old kid to go live in a duplex, you know, it's worse than that, it's like sending a fourth grader to go live in a duplex alone and be rehabilitated.
And not write letters.
Well, did the cutout of the small boys that he's kept a secret, did that have anything to do?
It had to do, I think, with the exercise of discretion.
And when did
that
occur?
It wasn't alleged as a violation.
That's right. It wasn't a violation. And when did that occur? My recollection is that came right after he was released, like day one or day two.
He took them out of the institution.
It wasn't like he was on supervised release and was violated. That's why they didn't charge him with a violation.
Did it concern Judge Mason that at the time he was being released on supervised release, he was secreting cutout pictures of young boys? Yeah. And should it have? I think so.
No, I'm not.
Didn't they medicate him for that?
I'm sorry?
Didn't they medicate him for that?
And well, they did.
Curtail his fantasizing?
They did apparently change his meds. It's not clear to me from the record whether it was successful or not. Reported apparently that,
Let's just go back.
Was somewhat helpful, and then within about a week had also reported fantasies again. I don't know.
I'm going to bring you back to State v. Jefferson. You think that this court should say the court is permitted but not required to consider alternatives to revocation.
Right.
When you say alternatives to revocation, that's the same meaning as the defendant puts to least restrictive placement.
Well, I wouldn't, as long as you don't tie it to a due process requirement or a requirement of the statute, I would say that it doesn't reach any different result than a trial court exercising jurisdiction under 08 would reach.
I'm going to take you through the procedure that I asked the defense counsel.
You mean for transfer of 51 patients?
Well, yeah. Well, if you have anything that you give me on that, that's fine. But on this 980, so we got him here. He's a violation. And I then asked defense counsel, what does the court look at? So
After violation's found?
Violation is found. Now we're going to see whether, just because there's a violation, we don't have to revoke, right?
That's right.
All right. So what are we going to look at? We're going to look at his behavior. We're going to look at the original grounds that he was convicted of the sex offense, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to see if I can do something less than revocation. That's your position.
I'm sorry?
I don't, as trial judge, I don't have to look at anything less than revocation, that if there are other alternatives.
You're not required to.
I'm not required to. So, defendant says, you want to say that there are alternatives to revocation, judge. I say, I'm not interested in alternatives to revocation.
Well, that...
I think that that he has violated probation. The psychologists say supervisory release is okay, but listen, we got a danger to the public. He's carrying pictures of little boys around. He's lying to the probation officer, but not to the psychologist. But we got somebody who is borderline on mental retardation. And when I look at all that, I want to protect the public, and I'm not interested in alternatives to revocation. Have I erroneously exercise my discretion?
Has the defense presented any possible alternatives to
I'm not going to let him because I'm not interested. I'm not required under...
Well, but I think...
I'm not required under State v. Keating, which this court issues, to look at alternatives. I am not required.
A refusal to look at it.
Pardon?
It's not erroneous exercise.
I'm not required to do it. I don't have to do it. My exercise, my discretion not to do that.
I'm not urging this court to hold that a trial court can absolutely refuse to look at alternatives that the defendant proposes. In my view, while that's not required, if the defendant were to propose alternatives to the revocation and the trial court didn't deal with those in any way, I think that that's probably an erroneous exercise of discretion.
That's a substantive due process question that the Romano court held back.
I'm sorry?
Isn't that precisely the substantive due process question that the Romano court held back?
It is. But
it's only an absolute refusal or a statute that precludes it might be a violation of substantive due process, but anything...
The statute, I disagree with Mr. Keating's characterization of Romano. I do not think that they refused to deal with substantive due process. What they refused to deal with was automatic revocation. And they didn't need to because the Missouri statute gave the court discretion. Now, did they deal with substantive due process in Romano? I think they did. They did it rather cursorily, but they did it. Two paragraphs. And the only thing it's Roman numeral 3 of the opinion, which in the official report I believe begins on the bottom of page 615. And the first thing they do is say, well, we've already decided that due process doesn't require it procedurally. Which I think may raise a very interesting question, because if you don't require some sort of recitation in the opinion, how on earth does this court review the exercise of the substantive due process claim from the trial court? But setting that aside, they just then go through, here's what the evidence was. We think this was an appropriate thing upon which to revoke the guy. No violation. Not a lot of guidance for us, but there it was. They dealt with it. And if you look at our case in the same light, I think you end up with the same result. There's no due process requirement for it to be there procedurally, And if you look at the reasons that the trial court gave for revoking, was that a violation of substantive due process? I don't think so. He was concerned about the dangerousness of the individual, the protection of the public, and he believed, based on all of that, that the appropriate level of security was a secured mental health facility.
Does this record indicate that the respondent was given an opportunity to present alternatives?
He was, well, I don't know whether he did or not. He was certainly given an opportunity to present evidence. He was given an opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses. And the judge himself asked the probation agent about alternatives. So it seems to me that there was a fair opportunity that if Mr. Keating had had something specific to propose to the court, it's, I think Judge Mason was receptive to considering it. I don't know if he'd adopted it or not. I mean, he had the same history that we all have, how hard it was to find a place for him to begin with. But I do think he had the opportunity, and I don't think it's fair to ask judges to have to try to consider alternatives in the abstract. That's certainly not what happens in probation. The probation agents list what alternatives they consider on their revocation reports, and what the ALJs at hearings and appeals do, none of this is in the record, but from talking to those folks over there, they determine whether or not the agent's consideration of alternatives was reasonable or not, in their view. And if it was, they considered alternatives of revocation. That seems like a reasonable approach.
That's what I was going to ask you, but then why put the burden on the defendant? In the probation or parole revocation, the burden is on the state to say, there are no reasonable alternatives. And that's what the court did here. The court said, is there an alternative to returning him to the resource center, which the state considers appropriate, or is this the only option available?
Right.
So who has the burden to show that there are no other alternatives?
Well, I would suggest that under the current statutory scheme, it's the defendant. If the state had to do that, then the legislature would have put it in the statute. And if you look at 5135, which is the transfer provisions under Chapter 51, that's exactly the way the statute reads. The court has to make a determination about least restrictive alternatives, and it has to be proposed by the state, and they have to give notice to the committed person. None of that's in this statute. Same legislature. It seems to me that if what Ms. Maroney's asking you to do here is to rewrite Chapter 980 to look like 5135. But the legislature didn't do that.
Here's what the state said. Is Mr. Wolf representing the state here? Yes, the assistant district attorney. In response to what the court saying, what does the state consider? Is there any other option? State says, I think the only option is if the court finds that it's significant grounds to return him or decides not to return him. I think it will be similar to probation revocation type hearing. Either the court feels that it is appropriate information to revoke or it's not. If the court finds it's not, then I think community supervised release would continue. So they're saying that we've got to, that's what the court has defined, without giving the court any options, without saying to the court.
Most likely because there was none. I mean, and that's part of the problem we have here. I mean, I think Ms. Maroney's right. If they would have proceeded on the revocation of probation or parole, they would have had more options. And the reason is because some of the private people who take those folks will take them if they are on probation, but not if they're on supervised release. And there's not a lot that the state can do about that.
Why can't the state be responsible for building or buying or providing this kind of placement?
It's a good question, and I wish the legislature would answer it. But they haven't done it. And as we know, we had a case here before this court not too long ago where there may be a dispute about whether such a facility is supervised release or not. So, I mean, it is a very difficult problem.
I mean, it is a bit of a fantasy for us to be arguing whether or not the court must consider least restrictive alternatives when none exist.
But I don't think the court has the facility to create them. I'm not sure how much DFSS has. They have tried.
Well, what's wrong with this? Let's say there's no treatment at all for sexual predators. Let's say that. Does that make any difference?
Well, I don't know if it would. That's an interesting question. And I'm not sure how the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, would come down on that. If somebody had a mental disorder that was untreatable and they were substantially dangerous, could the state commit them? I don't know.
I meant that no treatment was provided.
My view of that is that that's what 5161 is there for, and that's why it applies to Chapter 980 people. If they're not getting treatment, then what they need to do is they need to go into the circuit court and say, DHFS is violating my patient rights because I have the right to treatment under that subsection.
That's why 980 in part is it's treatment and protection. And, I mean, that was the thesis, right?
But I'm sorry?
Treatment and protection were the two underlying motivations.
That's right.
Of 980.
That's
and
right.
Treatment is a figment of our imaginations. And if alternative placements is a figment of our imaginations, then the only thing we have left is putting them away for protection.
Well, I don't think treatment's a figment of the imagination. There may be a substantial debate about how effective it is, but I don't think there's ever been a problem of any of these folks, in or out, being offered treatment.
Okay, let me just see if I understand your position. Your position is that if the court actually refused to consider least restrictive alternative or an alternative revocation, that would be an erroneous exercise of
duty. Well, I think that's the way you would analyze it, and it well might be, yes.
And it might be substantive due process, but at least it's an erroneous exercise of due process. That it's up to the defendant, not the state, to show that there are alternatives.
I think the court could require the state to do it if it felt that that was appropriate.
Okay, so you don't take a position on who has
I think if the defendant presents an alternative, okay, the court should deal with it. If the court, taking all the circumstances into account, believes that the state hasn't tried hard enough, or that there may be something out there that the state's overlooked, it's free to say to the state, I don't think you've done enough. You need to do some more. And I think that's perfectly within the circuit court's power. And they should do that, if that's the case. But I don't think there should be a requirement either on the state or on the defendant to come forward. If they choose to do that, the court should deal with it. And if the court believes that there may be some avenues that haven't been explored, it should require DHFS to do that. Just as on occasion, as I hope I argued in Sprosty, it may be appropriate in certain instances for the circuit court to order the county to create something. And they should do it. When the court believes that's appropriate, it should do it. But I don't think we should place this kind of a mechanical requirement on the state, which may well be an exercise in futility, and I don't think really adds anything to what the statute already requires the court to do before the court exercises its discretion. And when it does exercise its discretion, we should look at that just the way we do probation and parole. Did the state prove the violation by clear and convincing evidence? If yes, did the court erroneously exercise its discretion in reaching its conclusion? And all of these circumstances that we talked about may play into that.
Well, when there's proof that the state is unable to provide a less restrictive alternative, there are statements that they could do it under the Department of Corrections if they revoke probation, but can't do it under the Department of Health and Family Services. Do you think that's an erroneous exercise of discretion that they didn't push farther?
Well, I don't know that it is. I guess it could be. Maybe the court should step in and try to. I suspect that that's a dispute between DOC and DHFS, and perhaps the court didn't want to get in the middle of that because I think they end up dealing with both of those people. But
you think that's correct for the court to do that when you're dealing with?
Well, I don't know based on that one statement that was the situation here, but I would think if the evidence sufficiently developed it, which I haven't seen yet. That might be appropriate. I suspect that there are a lot of trial judges who wouldn't want to put themselves in that position.
And it might be an erroneous exercise of discretion if the court didn't develop
it. I don't think it was in this case. I can envision a case where it might be.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Ms. Maroney?
Thank you. Well, as I said, I took a look at Chapter 51, and I guessed wrong. No, it isn't a recent overt act that's necessary. It's a violation similar to the wording in the Chapter 980 revocation statute. But there is a significant difference, and that is that the department, or we could say the state, it has the burden of proving the least restrictive alternative. And that's in 5135 sub 1, sub E, sub 4. And the fact that the state has a burden is what also distinguishes this case from Jefferson. In that case, the state not only had to prove a violation, but they also had to prove that the safety of that person or others requires that the conditional release be revoked. So that was part of the state's burden of proof, that it showed that there was dangerousness. And I guess going back to questions before about burden of proof, that if we leave it up to the courts may, if they want to, allow defense attorneys to put in evidence. It is putting the burden of proof on the committee or the committed person when it's the state that is seeking to deprive the person of their liberty, so the burden should be on the state. And I guess the question had come up about the medication, and the evidence there was that it was proving to be helpful. The point that it got discussed was that Mr. Ketting had told his agent that now that he was on the medicine, he wasn't having fantasies. Well, he had previously told her that he hadn't had any fantasies at all. And so she confronted him with the fact that if you're telling me now you're not having any fantasies, you must have been lying when you told me before that you never had them at all since you were released. And I guess that's encouraging to know that there are options out there like the medication that can reduce the dangerousness. And also, I guess this just also ties in with the particular facts of the case. Mr. Ketting had a specific disability, a cognitive disability, which made it hard for him to retain information. And Mark Twain said, always tell the truth and you won't have to remember as much. And that might have been a problem for Mr. Ketting. He's not a sophisticated person. He's not a sophisticated person who's going to be able to litigate and assert his rights. That's why we have to put the burden on the state in cases like this. So on behalf of other similarly situated people, I would hope that the court would make it a requirement, because I think that there will be continuous litigation on this issue because of the great stake, which is a lifetime commitment. Thank you.
So, I gather you would like to see an opinion written then on the basis of 980 and 51 that the court must consider alternatives to revocation, and that it's up to the state to tell the court what such alternatives there are, if there are none, or that the state say that it is absolutely no alternative for this person. Is that the way you want the opinion written?
Well, yes, and I guess the what Mr. Weinstein mentioned about if there's a violation of patients' rights, there's a cause of action for the individual, that would present the individual with some way to seek a remedy. So that's one thing that the court, by recognizing the least restrictive alternative as being one of the patient's rights, perhaps someone will be able to conduct an evidentiary hearing and basically hold the department's feet to the fire and say, okay, you've been saying you're going to develop some resources for these people. Put your money where your mouth is.
Well, that's a good place to end, Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Maroney, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein. That concludes our hearing in 00-1700, Wisconsin versus Keating.